This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Along with your calls at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, some interesting research.
Yes, twins, twin births. How can you get twins in your family if you're trying to have babies? What if you want to have twins? What should you do?
Let me tell you, there's nothing I could do to help me get twins in my immediate family. I do, though, as you know.
That's right.
Have twin grandkids.
That's exactly right. And for people who want twins, stay tuned. And we're going to talk about a study that looks at a widely used nutritional supplement supposedly to lower cholesterol that does not work.
Oh,
talk about some research for that.
And you'll want to stay tuned because we have a medical myth buster.
Yes, our medical
coming
myth
up later on in the program.
Up.
What's our recipe?
Our recipe is pecan encrusted trout. It's great if you love trout. If you're looking for a new fish recipe, this one is dynamite and it's easy.
I think trout is my favorite fish.
It's easy.
800-462-7413 is the number to call if you'd like to talk with Zorba. A listener joins in now in Montgomery, Alabama. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate that call. What's up?
Well, I'm a runner. I've been running for about 30 years. I am approaching 60 right now in a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And I was working on my daughter's sob the other day, and leaning over the hood too long, I guess I hyperextended one of my knees, and I noticed then trying to run again was a little painful.
Oh, okay. How was the sob?
It's fixed.
Sob is fixed. That's what counts, you know. When you've got a kid's car that you got to fix, if you fix the car, that's what counts. Next question. So,
absolutely.
Anyway, so you're leaning over the car. Tell me, how are you positioned around that?
Well, I guess I was bending my knee the wrong direction, mm-hmm. backwards, I suppose. Then I went running afterwards, and it was very painful. So
Now, wait a second. I'm going to go back a step.
Okay.
So, you're fixing your daughter's sob. You're bent over the sob. When you're finished with that, did you have pain?
A little bit. It was more stiffness then.
Okay. And then you went, and how far did you run?
4 miles.
4 miles. That's a good run. That's a good run. I wouldn't call that a small little run. That's a good run. But you run how many days a week?
My goal is 20 miles a week, usually 4 miles at a time.
Okay. So what are you doing? Tell me what you're doing now to try to rehabilitate that leg.
Well, what I've found works for it right now is a cross trainer machine that's non-impact, a little bit of cycling,
good.
And I've actually been able to do recently a little inline skating too.
Good.
But I'm worried about the cardiovascular benefit of those versus what I was doing.
If you're worried about your heart and cardiovascular risk factors, you'll get more bang for your buck, frankly, by taking an aspirin every day than by jogging every day. Now, it's interesting. I'm not recommending that you don't jog. Jogging is great. It's cardiovascular. It moves things around.
That would be my recommendation, that you don't jog.
That you don't jog. That's right.
You're too old to jog.
There you go. You've got Tom's recommendation. Give up the jogging. Take the pills. Forget that all and start watching television. But if you're worried from the cardiovascular point of view of prevention of heart attack, you get a lot of bang for your buck out of aspirin. And frankly, jogging gives you a decent amount of bang for your buck. And it's part of it, but it's only part of it. 2 weeks isn't going to do much. 4 weeks is not going to make a difference. It's your overall lifestyle. It's more important for you to rehabilitate your leg than it is to jog. My recommendation, whenever you have a significant injury over the age of 50, it takes 6 weeks to get back into shape at minimum. Now, you might go back jogging in 4 weeks, but frankly, your body doesn't heal the same way as it did when it was 18. And you got to make it longer. Otherwise, you're going to end up more likely to end up with something that might be
What chronic. About his question about the alternatives to jogging?
Oh, I think what you're doing with a cross trainer is something that's non-impact. But it's going to take you 4 to 6 weeks. Pay attention to that 60-year-old body, and it'll keep you going well through your 90s, probably.
Great.
Up through your 90s.
Thanks for the wonderful advice.
And remember, keep that sob going, and your daughter will be happy.
That was a guarantee from Dr. Pastor, that living to his 90. 800-462.
Money back guarantee.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right.
Let him call. It's a money back guarantee.
That's right.
You call us 30 years from now. Make sure we know.
If you go before then, let Zorba know. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Question for Zorba, give us a call. A listener with us now, Zorba in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hey, guys. What's shaking?
pretty
good.
Pretty well.
How about with you?
Well, I'll tell you. I have recently taken up boxing as a form of exercise.
Boxing?
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 36.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately, I would like to have, you know, an amateur fight before I'm 40. It's just something, you know, my grandfather was a Golden Gloves boxer, and I got into it a little late, but it's a great exercise, and I really enjoy it.
Uh-huh. So, you know, boxing was really big in the 50s and the early 60s. Wisconsin was a great boxing sort of powerhouse until there was an injury here, and it took a month for this young man to die from head injuries of boxing. And then boxing, when it was on TV, was big, and then there were a couple of injuries where they die. I mean, it's a sport that's associated with significant problems later on. Why? I mean, your grandfather was in Golden Gloves, but it's, you know, you run more of a risk.
Well,
I don't know if the risk is more
than
motorcycle.
I'm not doing it to get serious and to go in and fight some professional guy and get my head knocked in.
Uh-huh.
It's really just more of a hobby for exercise. Yeah. And
have you bitten anyone's ear?
Not yet.
That's disgusting, Tom.
You don't even know about Mike Tyson thing.
Yeah, Mike. Of course.
Oh, come on. Okay.
I mean, everyone and his grandmother knows about Mike Tyson and the ear by Evander Holyfield, right? Wasn't that the one? See?
Right. Yeah.
See?
I
can play Trivial Pursuit. I can do that. So how can we help you?
Okay, here's the thing. When I am sparring and I'm holding my hands up in the defensive position, you know, got my gloves up.
Okay.
After a while, two or three rounds, in my shoulders, I get this fatigue, kind of like a burning. I can't hold my arms up.
Oh, okay. After how long? After two or three?
Two or three, you know, 3-minute rounds, three-minute rounds, it starts getting to where it's too painful for me to keep my guard up. You know, and I've noticed it later now, like holding the phone to my ear for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, this is not an exceptionally long period of time. What sort of weight training do you do?
Well, just normal weight, nothing excessive.
Twice a week? How many times a week? For how long?
Three times a week, more for toning than strength building.
This is in both shoulders?
Both shoulders, right.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some issues here that are involved. This sounds to me like you may have a bursa is a fat pad between a muscle and a bone, basically. And these pads, when they're hit, when they're banged on by someone, when you fall and hurt them, or when use them excessively, can become inflamed. And you may have a subdeltoid bursitis or another form of a shoulder bursitis. There are other small bursa that are around the shoulder, and sometimes an injection of a steroid into the bursa can turn this around. Sometimes an anti-inflammatory like 2 Aleve tablets twice a day, over-the-counter, cheap, inexpensive.
Uh-huh.
But 2 Aleve tablets twice a day can make a difference. And that can also reduce the inflammation. But it sounds to me like this might be a bursitis, and I think I'd have it looked at because you're not holding your arms up for an excessive period of time. You're not saying after 2 hours,
I can't
hold it up. This is not, and especially if it's now bothering you when you hold up the phone. The phone is obviously not a heavy object.
No.
And so it's that position. And I would have it looked at. I think you might have a bursitis. You clearly have some inflammation that's happening in the shoulder or about the shoulder that should be attended to. So it might be the bursa. It might be the muscles about the rotator cuff that are doing it. Unless you've had when you're sparring, you're going to get trauma on your shoulder, clearly, because that's what you're moving forward
so
with.
So your goal is one amateur fight, and then you're going to quit?
Yeah.
And you're not going to do one of these anything goes. You can kick them and punch them and bite them.
No.
Those
are awful.
No,
those
I want it as regimented as possible.
Well, good luck to you. I think that's an interesting goal, given your grandfather's history.
Yeah,
and that
all is.
That. I think that's an
interesting
thing you're going to do.
I think that is neat.
Good luck with it.
So thank you guys so much.
Hope you have a retire with a perfect record.
I appreciate that. I'll do my best.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye.
Isn't that interesting?
That is very interesting. You know, it's interesting because I think of boxing as being high risk, but the more I think about it, I don't know what the per unit of time time is for boxing risk in amateur versus in professional. Professional is a different thing.
Oh, yeah.
Heavyweight boxing, all of that, and those crazy things where, where there's anything that goes and you try to destroy the other person.
Yeah.
That is high risk. But in amateur boxing where you're hitting each
other,
I don't know.
You wear the protective gear.
Well, I don't know where the risk is compared to, for instance, soccer, where you wear no protection at all, you know, other than cups to prevent your genitals from being injured. I don't know where the risk rate is, and that's rather interesting. It might not be any higher than some other sports that we, you know, that we accept in our society.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a caller now in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I've had a numb arm off and on for the past year.
Okay.
My left arm goes numb and has a heaviness to it. And so I've been talking to my GP about it, and she sent me to several specialists. And when she sent me to the neurologist, he made a comment. He took my family history and he took my medical history, and then he said, well, given your age, everyone over a certain age.
Given has, your age.
Yeah, given
your
my age. Given your age. 42, by the way.
You know, by the way, the subtext of that is, given your age, you old person, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's what I thought, too.
Sure.
But he said everyone over a certain age has an abnormal MRI. You're going to have spots on it, and we'll have to explore them, and I don't want to put you through that.
So I'll tell you something. He's got some important points there. He's absolutely right. What happens is the MR scan is picking up things that do not have any disease in them at all, and we don't know what they mean. So, for instance, good example of an MR scan. If I go out on the streets of any city in America and I MR scan 100 people who do not have back pain, between 10 and 20% of them will show significant back disc disease on an MR scan. Therefore, the presence of a disc on an MR scan does not mean you are going to have back pain. It's very interesting. The same is true when we do MR scans of the brain. We're now finding out people who have these sort of spots on the MR scan, and the MR, you know, the reader, the radiologist who reads it goes, well, this might be multiple sclerosis and it might be not. And all of a sudden the person is worried about MS and you do a whole bunch of other tests. Very hard to prove MS other than an MR scan in a person without symptoms. You can't disprove it. And then for the rest of the life, the person may have trouble getting insurance. They're worried they're coming up with multiple sclerosis. So I am pro not getting any scan, any test, unless you have a reason, because it picks up a lot of things that have that are basically junk and noise in the system. Now, why did you want to have the test done?
Well, this numb arm has concerned me for a year. It comes and goes.
Yeah.
And my uncle has MS, and my grandfather had Parkinson's disease. Uh-huh.
Now, we know that Parkinson's disease, except in certain people, is not inherited. We know that MS does not appear to be inherited at all. I think getting clinical judgment from a good neurologist or somebody who you trust as a physician is fine. And frankly, the issue is most of these things we don't treat. Now, there are blood tests that sometimes we do. There are drugs that can cause numbness. But for the most part, getting an MR scan of the brain is not going to give you information. So I think when a doctor says you don't need the test, I think you like that doctor. You think they have good judgment. I think that that's reasonable. And there's lots of testing that's done for bogus reasons.
Yeah.
We do literally 3 to 4 times as much testing as they do in places in Europe. And our health statistics are worse than any other place practically in Western Europe than you can think of. So the tests clearly do not produce a reduction of disease. So I sit with that.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank
You're
you very much for the call.
Welcome.
We appreciate it. 800-462-7413. Research on twin births, Zorba, and a way that those who want them may be able to get twins.
Yes. You want twin births, and you're a woman who have childbearing potential, you just sock down those dairy products, and you might get twin fraternal births.
Drink milk.
Drink milk. From Wisconsin, that's what we're telling you. Drink milk, eat cheese, eat
now,
yogurt,
what,
have that ice cream.
What in the world is the basis?
Well, it's very interesting. First of all, we're looking at fraternal twins versus identical twins. Identical twins do not appear to be part of this study.
Oh, my grandkids are identical
twins. Fraternal twins are where there are two eggs. Identical twins are where there's a cleavage of the egg. They have the same genes, and what happens is the egg then separates and becomes two separate humans, but it's one genetic, you know, they have identical genetic structure. So they looked at fraternal twins and went back into data in the medical records of moms. This was a study out of Albert Einstein Medical School, which is in New York. And they found that if you have an increase in dairy products, yogurt, milk, cheese, ice cream, and so on, that you appear to be roughly 4 to 5 times as likely to have fraternal twins as if you did not consume lots of dairy products. Now, they compared, for instance, women in this particular study were compared to vegans. Vegans are vegetarians who don't eat any dairy products
at
all.
Right.
And we've known for years that vegans have a lower twin rate than women who are on dairy products, but it might be that dairy products increase something which is called insulin-like growth hormone within the body, stimulate it, or they consume it out of dairy products, and these things may be associated with the increase in the twin
some
rate.
Some are suggesting with this research that it's the BGH in the milk that's causing
some are suggesting that, but we know that when you consume dairy products that have BGH, your body actually destroys the BGH in the stomach. So there are people who say, no, it's the BGH in the herd. Roughly a third of all the milk that's produced with BGH, you cannot find the BGH in the milk when you test for milk. In other words, there's no test to find the BGH in the milk. That doesn't mean it isn't there. That means we just can't find it. That means it might be there.
So you don't believe that that's possible?
No, I don't believe it at all.
No, how about?
And I've never believed it. I followed the BGH controversy for years. I don't think the BGH is detectable in milk and does something. Now, keep in mind, there are a lot of people in the farming community who don't agree with that. And I respect that. And I've always been for labeling of milk because I know I'm going to get emails on this. And I've always thought you can separate that out. But there's no study now. I think an excellent other study would be to look at organic milk consumers who are in, quote, guaranteed herds that don't have BGH and compare those to vegans. That would be an excellent study, and that would lay this to rest.
Yeah, because vegans, of course, have other qualities other than not drinking
milk. Right. They have other qualities. Yeah. They also tend to weigh less. They tend to eat fewer calories.
Right.
They tend to have other things. So when you're doing the comparison of the vegan diet, you're also looking at the vegan diet that may be a lower twin diet. We know that twins are more common when you eat more calories. We know that as soon as you have fewer calories, you have fewer twins overall. That as soon as you're in a, for instance, environment where there may be starvation, there are fewer twins that are born. And in war-torn situations, there are always fewer twins. So there's a calorie issue. But this study shows it's also a dairy issue in America. So if you want to have twins, sock on, eat that dairy, and you might get those twin baby boys, baby girls, or boy girls.
Very interesting.
Yes.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. A listener joins in now, Zorba, in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Yes, hello, Zorba. Hello, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good.
Fine. How can
we
help you?
Good. I actually had a question. I'm looking into donating my eggs, and I'm having a horrible time finding reputable sources. At this point, all I have is to trust the Internet, and not saying it's a bad thing, but I am a little bit apprehensive of it. Uh-huh.
Have you been eating your dairy products?
I have. Okay. I don't. I'm glad I didn't have twins. As a young mother, that would have been too much.
How old is your baby, by the way?
He'll actually be 2 in November.
He'll be 2. Now, how big is the city you live in? Do you have an in vitro fertilizer?
Is actually, nobody's ever heard of it, but it's where University of Kentucky is located.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Actually, around the second largest city in Kentucky.
Yeah, and I've been to Lexington numerous times. It's a wonderful city. Do they have an in vitro fertilization clinic?
I really don't know. Like you said, I'm on the very beginning of
that's
my little
That's where I
right
would
now.
Start. And the reason is, if you start with the University of Kentucky, if you start with any university in vitro fertilization clinic, to me, you're then dealing with a reputable institution. I mean, I think that when you're dealing with a university institution, it is, for me, the talisman of a reputable institution. I'm not saying that 100% of the people in the institution are reputable, but the risk is really low.
Yeah.
When you deal with private institutions, especially with in vitro fertilization, there's a lot of muck in the system. There really is. There are a lot of people who are they're very money-oriented systems. There are some people where their heart is in the right place, and they're very reputable, and they're very good. And then there are a lot of, they're not charlatans, but there are a lot of people which are very, very money-oriented. And I've talked about this because I had a doctor in India who I've had a relationship with, medical relationship, wonderful, wonderful doctor, and he wrote me some information. He said, we have relatives in the U.S., relatives of relatives, they're sort of distantly related, and they'd like to know about in vitro fertilization. So I did some research on it. I spoke to some local people who I know and discovered that there's a broad spectrum. There are people who are highly reputable, and there are people who are highly disreputable, and you've got to separate that out. And the way you do that, I think, is by a university source. So I would go to the University University of Kentucky, I would call up the OBGYN department. I would say, who is reputable in our area? And if they say, we don't know anyone, then in Kentucky, I would call up Louisville. Because in Louisville, you're once again, you've got in vitro fertilization clinics, university clinic. If you've got eggs that are, you know, that are good eggs, they're going to jump at the chance of doing that. And if you want to do a good deed like that, more power to you.
Okay, perfect.
More power to you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks
so much.
A lot for the call. We appreciate it. And Zorba, before we get to our recipe, let's slip in an email from our inbox. This
Okey-dokey.
This one from Dale in New Hampton, New York.
Okay.
Dale says that he must be getting old because he and his wife would rather listen to our show than go out.
Obviously is not a teenager at this point.
We tend to skew old here on Zorba Pastor.
Well, I don't know if we skew old. We skew a little bit young, a little bit of old. But yeah, we certainly skew people who are interested in their health.
Here's his question. Dale's wife is a chef, and just like you, Zorba, she recommends sea salt over run-of-the-mill table salt.
Right.
Dale would like to know if the lack of iodine in sea salt is a problem to our thyroid health.
Well, no, the answer is yes. You don't want to just eat sea salt. I agree with that 100%. Iodine has wiped out goiter in this country. Iodine is very, very important, and people often do not get enough fish. And I think sea salt is great when you're using it on top of certain foods that you're eating, but on the whole, I would not use. Well, sea salt may have a little bit of iodine, but it's not iodine fortified.
Yeah.
So I think that it should be supplemental salt, but it should not be the only salt that you eat.
Gotcha.
Good point.
We like hearing from you, whether it's a tip, a recipe, or you're just trying to stump our favorite family doc. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
That recipe is coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Zorba Pastor on Your Health, Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, and with you if you'd like to join us on the phone at 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. We welcome your calls. We appreciate them. We love your calls most of the time, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Most of the time. 100% of the time.
Well,
24/7.
Maybe 96% of the time.
96 and 99 and 96.
But as much as we love them, we're going to put them off because it is recipe time.
Yes, recipe time.
Our recipe, this one for pecan encrusted trout,
which sounds delicious. Which is delicious. It is delicious. And you could use this with tilapia, which is a different fish. You could use this with salmon. I love this with trout. Now, you said you like trout.
Yeah.
Trout's your favorite fish?
I think so.
I love salmon. I find salmon as my favorite
fish. I
love salmon.
I don't count salmon. For some reason. I don't know why.
You don't count salmon? You mean salmon? Category. It's in a different class.
Yeah.
It's in a different class.
Yeah, but no, I'm the fish.
Okay. You like trout. Okay. We won't count salmon. Okay, start out with 1/2 cup of pecans, finely chopped.
1/2 cup of finely chopped pecans.
Now, you know, nuts are great. Nuts have omega-3 fatty acids in them. We know that people who eat nuts appear to have lower heart disease and stroke. Peanuts are not nuts. They're legumes.
Right.
They don't count the same. You can use pecans. You could probably use walnuts in this. Mm-hmm. You could probably use almonds. It could be almond-encrusted trout. I happen to like the taste of this with pecans.
Okay.
1/2 tablespoonful of sesame seeds.
1/2 big tea sesame seeds.
Now, if you are my wife, you will not use sesame seeds in this because you don't like sesame seeds. I love sesame seeds, and that's the big discussion within a house.
With this recipe, couldn't you do it 1/2 and 1/2 if you were cooking?
Yes, I could. Yes, I could. Half of it, I could make mine with the seeds and without, because that would be very simple to do. 4 trout fillets that are boneless.
4 boneless trout fillets.
That's right. 4 boneless trout fillets. Whether you catch it and it's wild trout or whether it's farm-raised trout, I have no idea when I buy it in my grocery store. It must be farm-raised. Can't be wild trout.
I would imagine,
It has to be farm-raised. 2 teaspoons of butter.
Too little tea butter.
Now, notice we're not using margarine. We're not using margarine. I mean, you've got four trout fillets and you've got 2 teaspoons of butter. How much butter are you eating?
Yeah.
I mean, we sometimes go nuts in our society and we go, well, don't have any butter. Butter is bad. I think that's ridiculous and it's not intelligent way to do it. What you want to do is you want to use butter the way you can use it for its taste and its delicious taste and use it in small amounts.
Right.
A half a teaspoon, which is per fillet, is a teeny tiny amount of butter. It's almost nothing. It's taking, you know, all that butter and slathering it over the bread in the morning. I mean, I use butter. I've gone back to butter on my toast, but I use a small amount of it, and I like the taste better.
I do, too.
You know, and now with trans fats, I realize that sometimes my advice for the years have said, you know, switch to margarine, not butter, has not always been right because it has to be the right margarine. So why not use butter in a recipe like this?
Why not?
It's a good way to use it.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Garlic clove minced.
A garlic clove minced.
Now, and salt and pepper.
S&P.
Yeah. Now, this is a good example where you're going to use only freshly ground pepper. Do not use powdered pepper. It's worthless. You can put it in the middle of a recipe, but on the outside, it's worthless. Throw it out. Get rid of it. And this is a good example of where you want to use kosher salt or sea salt. We know that we need iodized salt because we need iodine in order to function well.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a good example where you want to use the crunchy salt on the surface of it because it tastes better. When you've got a granule of crunchy salt, it really is a better taste than just salt out of the salt.
So we want to use the sea salt on this.
Sea salt or kosher salt, because kosher salt is the same way.
Right.
Okay, preheat the oven at 350 degrees. That's where you start. Now, finely chop the pecans, or buy them chopped already, which is often what I do rather than chop them. Transfer them to a small bowl, mix in the sesame seeds, then place the trout fillets on a baking sheet, and then season the trout with the salt and pepper. Once again, you ground the salt, you ground the pepper, use kosher salt if you're using it.
Mm-hmm.
Then in a small saucepan over lower heat, stir in the butter and garlic until the butter melts. Then brush the garlic-butter mixture over the trout fillets. Good example, using butter on the surface. You're not frying it, you're brushing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you use a small amount. Then sprinkle with the nut mixture and then chill it. Uncovered for 20 minutes.
Chill it.
What that is going to do is basically get the crust on the surface, so it's going to stay on it. It's going to go. It's going to seep into the skin a little bit better. The garlic is going to go into the skin. It's almost being marinated.
Yeah.
So you're using a smaller amount of oil, and you're getting it through the surface, so it's going to go into the fish. You could basically chill it for 3 to 4 hours. And by the way, before you put the fillets on, you should dry that. You should take a disposable cloth and dry them so that the fillets are dry. They're more likely to soak up the moisture with that. So
then,
chill it, uncovered.
Uncovered. Okay.
So basically, you're going to get a little dehydration of the butter. Bake it for 20 minutes. Simple. Simple, delicious, easy. It's one of those dishes you can have at the end of 20 minutes if you want to. You can shut off the oven. You don't have to serve trout super hot. In fact, but if you're in a restaurant, by the time it usually gets to you, it's at room temperature. Trout is okay. Fish is okay at room temperature.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it tastes differently when it's cold, but I will often make something like this, and I'll shut off the oven. We'll be having some nice white wine with our friends. We'll be having a little aperitif or something, and then I serve the fish.
This sounds very good.
Very simple, very easy, and very easy for you to get if you want to.
Little new potatoes, maybe some green beans.
Some green beans. Doesn't it sound good?
Ooh.
Let's have it tonight.
Let's
do that. Well, you can find this on our website at www.zorbapastor.org. You'll get there, you'll find it, and you'll find other wonderful recipes that we have.
Of course, we're happy to send you the recipe. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706. Be sure to include a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope. We're happy to send the recipe off to you. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. That means if you have a question for Zorba, you'll go to the phone and that's the number you'll call.
That's the number.
800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Wetumpka, Alabama. Hi.
Hey, how you doing, Zorba?
Good.
How can we help you?
My wife and I have been watching what we've been eating over the last couple of years. You know, just making sure of moderation of intake and then different types of foods. And lately we've been using turkey bacon instead of the pork bacon.
Okay.
And what we do is we cook it in the microwave rather than pan fry it.
Mm-hmm.
And we take a couple pieces of paper towels, lay some several strips of bacon on it, and then take one more piece of paper towel and put it on top, stick it in the microwave.
Mm-hmm.
Then we cook it for about 3.5-4 minutes at about 80%, rather than just going totally high, just be 80%.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes out nice and crispy, and all the excess fat that is in the bacon gets soaked into the paper towel.
You know, I've got to tell you something before you go on with your question.
Yeah.
You have done research on this. You have obviously tried various ways when you've got something that specific on making your bacon. You like your bacon. You want to have your bacon in a certain way. If it's too crisp, it's not good. If it's too dry, it's not good. If it's too moist, it's not good. So I want to congratulate you on doing the research. When I try to find something, this is exactly what I do. I like to try to find something that works really, really well. So I just want to tell you, I want to congratulate you for your work.
Well, it's trial and error is by everything.
Yeah, so. There we go.
Well, the question is, I know that a lot of people still pan fry, and I wanted to know, are we cutting off our nose to spite our face by microwaving it? Because over the long haul, is the microwave affecting the food if we eat too much food from the microwave?
No, not at all. I think that's the best way. I will occasionally eat bacon. I'll have bacon on a Sunday morning, especially if we have friends over, and I microwave it. When you microwave bacon, there's less oil in the bacon that you're eating. It's very
clear.
There is.
Clear. So his premise is
you
correct.
You bet. There's less oil in the bacon. You're doing it the right way. You are not. There is no evidence
and
that
that's something that actually tastes good from a microwave.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. It's the only thing we cook other than defrosting. It's the only thing in some vegetables that we warm up. We do not cook basically anything other than bacon in the microwave when we do stuff. So, yeah, I think it's a good way of doing it. And it's a good way of taking a high-fat item, and when it's done, it's still a high-fat item, but it has less fat. So what you've done is taken a taste you like, and you have made it better by microwaving it and then by using turkey bacon and then doing it the way that you like it so you can get the taste that you like. And to me, this is sort of the logical new way of eating. What happens is we are such a puritanical society that we go, oh, bacon, can't eat it. Bad, bad, bad. Well, I think that, to me, that's just over the edge. I think moderation and things are fine. You don't want to eat bacon, fine. If I want to eat bacon, fine. But if you're going to do it the right way. Turkey bacon, microwave, get away with much of the fat, and don't eat it every day. To me, that's the way to do it.
You did touch on a key word, moderation.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Moderation in all things. Moderation in all things. That's what Socrates said.
Yeah, well,
As
you know, Zorba, I was just on a little motorcycle run down to Memphis and
that's
back,
right.
And it occurred to me at the end of one of my days in Memphis that I had eaten pork three times during
three
that
times.
Day. I had sausage in the morning,
yeah, for
pork
breakfast.
Sausage.
Yeah, yeah.
I had ribs.
You had ribs for lunch.
At the Rendezvous.
At the Rendezvous.
Which were delicious.
I've been there. It's great. Rendezvous's great. I love it.
And a pulled pork sandwich
for supper. So that was not moderation in all things.
The next morning, I had a fruit plate. I thought there's something not quite right with this all-pork picture.
The all-pork diet of Tom Clark. There you go.
Thanks to the caller.
There you go.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. To a listener now in Columbia, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Good.
What's up?
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. How can
Here's
we help?
My question.
Yep.
My husband is a strict vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
He basically has not had meat or chicken or fish since he was 17.
Uh-huh.
He is now 40 years old, and somewhere along the way he stopped eating eggs as well.
Uh-huh.
And we have a 15-month-old son that he would like to raise as a vegetarian.
Uh-huh. Except for pork, huh?
Yeah, no pork as
no
well.
No pork, okay.
The no pork vegetarian cookbook.
Yeah, we're doing
there
it.
There we've got
so.
It, the no pork vegetarian. Vegetarian cookbook.
Anyway, I don't really mind, basically, but I just have some mixed feelings about it. One, I'd like a little bit more evidence-based medicine before I make such a crucial decision for my son.
Now, wait a second. Wait a second. Stop. Time out. What do you do for a living?
What do I do?
No, or what's your...
You're
going to
laugh. We're both veterinarians.
You're veterinarians. Because you said evidence-based medicine. That was too scientific a statement. No one who's out of...
Well, you seem to know the New England Journal of Medicine by heart,
who's
so I figured it would be a good
who's
source.
Who's out of the health field, out of the medical field, would ever say the word evidence-based medicine.
Right.
That's not a... lay term, if you will. Right. You're a member of the scientific clergy.
I turned myself in.
I turned myself in. You can be a vegetarian and you can be a vegan, and you can raise your child that is as a vegetarian and a vegan and do quite well. I mean, they do quite well. The issues are calcium. That's the issue in a growing baby. So you've got to get the calcium elsewhere, because we know that if you limit milk – now, are you limiting milk with your child?
No.
Okay. So if you're not going to be a vegan, if you're going to be a vegetarian, there is no issue at all. Babies are just fine. They tend to be when they're babies, they tend to be a little bit smaller. They are not smaller as adults at all. But their growth, they tend to grow a little bit less because they often get fewer calories. Mm-hmm. When you look at beef, you know, chicken, beef, poultry, which is commonly used in fish, which is only about 4% of the animal protein that we consume, it's a higher fat item. So they're more calories and the kids are bigger when they grow. But they're not bigger as adults. They're not and vegetarian babies. So that's okay. Milk is the issue because of calcium in the issue. And as long as your child's getting milk, I think you're perfectly fine.
Now, and that's my mom can sleep quietly, hopefully.
You bet. That is the evidence base that I give you. And thank you for using that term. All of the professionals in our audience will appreciate it.
Appreciate the call. Thank you.
800-462-7413,
our toll-free number. A question, maybe a bonus recipe for you now, Zorba.
Okay.
This comes from Ivy in Cedar Grove, Wisconsin,
okey-doke,
who writes, I recently received a recipe to make omelets using a Ziploc bag.
Mm-hmm.
Break one or two eggs into the bag, choose the ingredients you want to add, mm-hmm. close the bag, mm-hmm. and boil for 13 minutes.
Uh-huh.
The question, is it safe to boil a Ziploc bag?
Why does anyone want to do this? I guess that's the question.
Yeah.
Who wants to take a Ziploc boil it in water and make an omelet?
You end up with a boiled omelet instead of on the frying pan omelet.
Oh, it's an omelet out of a – I wonder what it tastes like. What would an – you know, I've got to try this. And then you've got to make sure the Ziploc bag doesn't open up in there, and then you – it's sort of a – it's kind of strange. I don't know whether or not you'll get some chemicals of plastic. I mean, Ziploc bags are not made for boiling, so I guess – I wouldn't.
You wouldn't do that.
I certainly wouldn't recommend it. And to me, I would think it sounds a little disgusting. Little Ziploc bag omelet. It doesn't sound organic. It's about as far away from organic as you can get. This, you know,
but
what they
boiled
do?
Is
they,
better than fried.
Yeah, well, you know, you can use the non-fried. Of all the things you can make without oil, if you're nuts about oil, you can use Pam, the nonstick spray. You can use a Teflon skillet. You can use plastic cookware, and you can make an omelet that has no fat in it, no appreciable fat, and you can do it. Why would you want to? You know what this reminds me of? Reminds me of shuttle food, the food they use on the shuttle. You know, people, you know, shuttle food. It reminds me of shuttle food or camp food. I'm going to make an omelet in the camp, and I'm going to break it. You know what? I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend it.
I think maybe we need more information from
how
it
tastes. No, I
don't
think so. I think there's no accounting for taste in the American society. And if you want to eat your boiled eggs, your boiled omelet in a Ziploc bag, you go right onto it. But I don't want any part of it. It's out of my field. Thank you very much. I love it. Send in those goofy recipes if you want to. All you want to. I want the goofy recipes as well as the good recipes. But I'm not going to have boiled eggs in a Ziploc bag. No, thumbs down. Thumbs down.
Your honk, hook,
pull it off the stage.
Your tips, comments, and questions, whether Zorba likes them or not, are welcome.
Boiled egg in a Ziploc bag?
Just send them to us at this email address.
Zorba@WPR.org.
This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls, some interesting research, and a medical myth buster coming up. I have a hard time saying that. Can you say that?
Medical myth buster. Yeah, but I'm a doctor.
Medical. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no problem. It's not a problem saying medical.
Doctors don't have
no, medical rules. It's part of getting part of getting into medical school. You have to say medical. It has to roll off your lips. It's the other part of the, you know, of the MCAT before you get into medical school.
Coming up here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. We're back with Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Glad to have you along. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, who has some research for us now on a study to see whether a nutritional supplement could improve cholesterol levels.
That's right. That's right. There's been a lot of hype on something called polycosanol, and I've had lots and lots of questions about it, patients who come in, emails, phone calls, and so on. And this is a waxy coating of sugarcane. It's interesting that Cuban sugarcane is considered to be the best source of polycosanol, even though you can get this supplement in wheat germ and in rice bran and beeswax. It's sort of been like the concept is, well, Cuban sugarcane is the best. Oh. And there's supposedly 80 trials on polycosanol. Now, what I find most interesting when you do the research on these 80 trials is that all 80 trials until now have been essentially supported by a Cuban sugarcane company.
Uh-huh.
So, in other words, there's a little bit of proprietary evidence here. You've got a research group in Cuba recommending that Cuban sugarcane is the best source of polycosanol. Yeah, so they've done all the research.
They have an interest in it, obviously.
Come on, obviously.
And they're also a bunch of commies.
Yeah,
so we can't trust them.
So we can't trust them. No, I don't want to. I don't want to get on the wrong side of the argument. But it's okay. Yeah. It's okay getting on the wrong side of this political argument. We're not discussing Cuba, but if you have one research group that's selling the product and doing the research, there is room for collusion. We know that because we live in America, which has the profit motive, and we know that collusion occurring in America just like
that. That's true. You can't trust us either.
So. Yeah, we're the capitalists. You can't trust us. We're trying to make the buck. The Cubans are trying to make the buck.
So,
but this is a study out of Germany.
They don't
grow sugarcane in Germany. We know that.
So we can.
We know
that. You can always trust Germany.
You can always trust German research.
Anyway, what's this research?
Okay, study is more than 140 patients, multi-center study, look at people, and half of them took polycosanol, half did not. Now, these are people who had to lower their cholesterol.
Yeah.
So they looked at their LDL, their bad cholesterol, their HDL, their good cholesterol, their total cholesterol. As I said, they were in five treatment groups. They were either getting 10, 20, 40, 80 milligrams of polycosanol or a placebo. Here's what they found. Nada. No difference. It did not affect their LDL or bad cholesterol. It did not affect their good cholesterol. It didn't affect their overall cholesterol. It did not do it anywhere near 10%, which is the minimal amount. Now, this stuff is hyped to be as good as statins. It is not. It is a worthless supplement based on this scientific study, and I think it's probably a worthless supplement because the whole hype has come from one research group that sells polycosanol.
And statins really do a good job.
Statins are a great drug, and if you want to lower your cholesterol in a natural way, use oat bran, use wheat bran. It does it. And if you're looking for something that's even better, you can use Metamucil, which does it, which is also a natural product. But polycosanol, not.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener now, Zorba, in Midland, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Pastor.
Hello.
How can we help?
My name is Kent, and I enjoy the show. I'm a former Badger, so it's always good to hear
from
Matt. Wait a minute. Aren't you still a Badger at heart?
Well, absolutely.
Oh, okay. All right. Then we'll take your question.
What's a Badger?
Well, I enjoy the show, and I enjoy the recipes, although, Dr. Pastor, I have to say that I'm with Tom on this whole avoid the tofu issue.
Great. Well, how can we help?
Well, my question is that I'm a 50-year-old guy, and I'm in good health. I exercise quite a bit. I run. I lift weights. I try to eat right. As part of my job, I have a sort of a basic physical about every 2 years. My total cholesterol was 249, but my HDL level was 81, and my LDL was 150. So I'm trying to figure out which numbers are important.
The HDL sounds like a great number, but the LDL
isn't so high.
Well, that's exactly it. Now, how old are you?
I'm 50.
Okay. Do you smoke?
No, I don't.
No, see, public radio people don't smoke.
Right.
You smoke. Do you exercise?
Quite a bit.
How's your diet?
Good diet. I follow your recipes, except for the tofu thing. I eat a lot of fish and chicken, things like that. Lots of
vegetables. Sounds perfect. Tell me about your family history. Who has longevity, your mom's side or your dad's side? So there's longevity somewhere in your family with an HDL of 81.
Yeah, my mom's side of the family, they tend to have this problem, as it were. They tend to have high HDL, but also high total cholesterol numbers.
Yeah.
And but they also seem to live a long time.
That's
live into
right.
their 80s and 90s.
That's right. They live well into their 80s and 90s.
And my dad is 86 and still working.
Yeah,
so.
That's exactly it. An HDL of 81 is incredibly protective. It really is. Now, it's very interesting. An LDL below 160 in your particular age group is perfectly fine. We sometimes over-treat the LDL. If you go to the NIH website and you look at the heart attack risk calculator, there's one on the National Institute of Health website, then there's also one on the CDC website. There might be one on the FDA website, but if you do heart attack risk calculator, that's what it's called,
okay.
and you put in these numbers, you'll find out that your risk is absolutely minimal. And so the answer is not to go on a statin by any means. But the reason why your cholesterol is so high is not just due to this LDL that's above 130, which is sort of the number that we shoot for, but it's also due to the fact that you've got this super high HDL.
Well, hearing that from a fellow badger, I'm going to try.
Thanks for listening, and we appreciate the call.
Thank you so much.
Zorba time now for our medical myth buster. Today we're going to be talking about eye color, not brown, blue, or hazel, but pink.
Pink.
It's a common thought that you should use antibiotics to help cure pink eye. Is this a myth or is it true?
Well, it's very interesting. It is a myth. It is a myth that you need antibiotics for pink eye in the fact that most pink eye is caused by viral infections. However, it's not a myth. And if you have pink eye, what you should do initially with pink eye. And the initial treatment for pink eye is to, of course, you know, wash the hands. It's usually spread in children. So wash your hands of the children and wash their eyelids with a dilute solution of water and baby shampoo, like Johnson's baby shampoo, because you wash that off. And often that in and of itself will take care of it. But the problem is if your child goes to daycare, they will not take your child in daycare until the pink eye is totally resolved. And even though it is a myth that pink eye is usually caused by a bacterial infection, it's caused by a viral infection, it is not a myth that often people use those drops in ointment because they've got to get their child back in daycare and the society around us wants us to treat it.
But is it sometimes caused by bacteria?
Oh, sometimes. It's probably about 20% of the time caused by a bacterial infection. But it's the same with ear infections, Tom. About 80% of all ear infections are caused by viral infections. You go to places such as Holland, they do not treat them with antibiotics. Mm. And in Holland, they don't treat pink eye with antibiotic ointment. What they do initially is they wash the eye and keep it clean. And what happens is 80% of the time, the child who usually has pink eye gets better. But it's not a myth that, once again, you have a difference between what society tells us to do, and often doctors, and what the actual evidence-based is. And so a lot of pink eye is caused by viruses. Give it a few days, keep the eye clean and wash it off, and the pink eye will resolve. If it's really goopy and really wet, and especially if it's tender, that's different.
A myth debunked.
Debunked. Debunked.
If you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, or if you have a question that you think could stump our favorite family doc, or if you just have a tip for us, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
To Ashland, Oregon now. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I have an addiction to pop-out gum, and it seems that when I go on my binge of chewing for several days at a time, my mouth gets aggravated.
Binge gum chewing.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard of binge drinking and, you know, and binge dating. There's binge gumball chewing.
This is the secret...
the secret life of gum chewers.
The secret hidden
That's
evil
right.
passion
That's right.
of America.
Going, of America. That's right. 5% of the population engages in binge gumball chewing.
This is a problem society has yet to adequately address.
Yet to address. Yeah. And more importantly,
we don't
have a federal program.
Yeah, that's right.
We don't have a federal program to control and evaluate binge gumball chewing.
There must be an election coming up. Let's deal with
this. Our youth has. Our youth is getting addicted to binge gumball chewing, and it's leading to tooth decay.
Yeah.
To tooth decay. So.
Well, my question is the sores that I get developed from chewing that, I'm curious about that because I've never had that happen until I got addicted to this gum.
Oh, so maybe so it's one gum that seems to cause the sores?
Well, one style of gum. Mm-hmm. It's that those It's not gumballs mm-hmm. now. It's the little tiny squares that pop out of those uh-huh. foil packets.
But is it only one gum in one square, or is it all squared gum made by different companies? That's what I would
look at. That's a good question.
Yeah, it is. I'm a scientist, you see. So it may be something in the gum. That may be it. It may be that you are developing basically.
Why don't you just chew some different kind of gum?
That pop-out gum is what I'm hooked on.
You're hooked on pop-out gum.
But once you get it in your mouth, gum is gum, isn't it?
No, not at all, Tom. I used to be in the gumball
family. I know your dad. Your dad used to.
Oh, gum is our, it's, gum. It runs in our family. I still have five relatives. Or in gum. So they don't. They do, but they're gumballs. They're not the pop out. That's the dark side. We're only in gumballs. But getting back to the dark side of the squares, it may be something within that gum. It may be whatever is used, oil of wintergreen or whatever is used specifically in the gum. I would try it. I doubt if it's the way the gum is milled. I don't think it's probably the squareness of the gum. I think it's probably something within the gum, and you may just have to. You may have to stop binge gum chewing of polar ice gum or whichever one you're having.
I did not want to hear that.
Oh, now, I have a question. When you binge, what's a binge?
Well, you know, I'll go and buy about four or five packs, and I may chew up to two packs a day.
Two packs a day for over how many day period?
Or maybe a week.
Uh-huh. Now, are you a weekend binge gum chewer or a weekday binge gum chewer? Or doesn't matter.
Weekday.
Yes. So some people binge on the weekend, other people binge on the weekday. You're the weekday. There may be something in the gum. That's what I would look at. And also, by the way, you can alter that by just altering sometimes the quantity. In other words, instead of chewing X number of pieces, you choose half as much, and then you supplement it with gumballs.
Moderation.
With gumballs. I got to lead into gumballs.
Yeah,
that's the bright side.
Once I get started, though, I can't stop. It's just like, you know, I'm popping those things in my mouth
I got it. It's an addiction. Yep. So, well, moderation in all things. That's the title of this show. Socrates said moderation in all things.
Except listening to Zorba Pastor Radio,
and there was no gumball and no polarized during his time.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Zorba, thank you.
A pleasure, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7444. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Ben and Leo Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0714Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org. That's zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.